This is the What Matters Most podcast. A 100% listener-supported program. And now, here is your host, Paul Samuel Dolman.
Welcome back to What Matters Most. Worldwide audience, wow, thank you guys. Keep listening, keep liking the show, recommending it, and also sending in guest suggestions. It really matters a lot. Today's guest came through just the most beautiful guy, great friend, longtime friend, Mr. Robert Matsuda, who is a concert-level violinist with all kinds of orchestras out in Los Angeles. Our guest today is a very successful author, a screenwriter, and a creator. And she has been kind enough in the middle of multiple deadlines to make a little bit of time for the What Matters Most family and me. So I am very, very grateful and also super excited to welcome to the family for the first time, Miss Paula Yeo. Thank you so much for coming on.
Hi, thank you. And my name is pronounced Paula Yeo. And it's really funny because when I was a kid, kids used to tease me and call me P-U. Get it?
Oh, I get it. And by the way, I should have asked you first because I've just been calling you Paula. So
yeah, no, that's okay.
It's not the show unless I blow the name. Even if it's Smith, it's Smythe. And if it's Smythe, it's Smith. That's part of the tradition. And I sometimes wonder if the guests are messing with me.
No.
Before we dive into some serious stuff, how have you coped with the last year of Corona?
Oh, thank you so much for asking. It's been hard. I mean, I literally have not left the house since March 2020, except for a few essential, you know, annual dentist cleanings and annual doctor checkups. But anything that's not essential, we haven't left the house. We have not even ordered takeout or delivery food, even though we know for the most part that's safe. We just want to try to help flatten the curve and, you know, not have people having to deliver food, or we're trying our best to just flatten the curve. And so what we do is, because we can't eat out at our favorite restaurants, we've been donating to restaurant worker industry charities and funds to help support restaurant industry people that way. And it's also because my husband is a teacher and I'm a writer, and we actually are working remotely from home. So we figured, since we can do that, we're privileged and lucky enough to do that, it's kind of our duty to, you know, stay at home. So we stayed at home. And I would say I would have stayed at home and quote-unquote socially distanced anyway, because I've been on so many deadlines. But we do miss our families. We haven't had a chance to physically see our moms in over a year and a half. So that's been a little sad for us. And unfortunately, I've had some friends pass from the virus, which also was quite devastating. And given the anti-Asian racism that's been increasing because of the pandemic and false accusations that, you know, it's our fault, quote unquote, that also has made me a little nervous to go outside. So those are the many reasons why I've been at home. But other than that, we're trying to remain positive and I'm looking forward to getting my vaccine soon, since I qualify now. So that's where I've been.
I was going to say, it doesn't seem to have taken a toll, and thank God you have each other, so you didn't go through isolation and deprivation.
Yeah, that's definitely true, and we try to call and check in with our friends whose only company are their plants or their pets. So, yeah, and it's devastating. You think about the toll. I mean, just even people who are neurodiverse and suffer from that's a terrible thing to say. I mean, people who are living with mental health and mental illness issues, and just families, parents, what they're having to go through, having to work from home, deal with their children who have to learn remotely, or parents whose children have gone to college and they're nervous for them because you don't know how safe it is out there right now. So we completely understand how difficult it is for everyone.
Quite a compassionate view. And then there's the economic aspects for, like you mentioned, with restaurant owners, workers. There's been more unemployment claims filed than we can keep track of. It's really been a challenging year. I think we might be turning the corner, I hope, a little bit under new leadership, thank God.
Yes. I'm very hopeful. And I do think that there is a light at the end of this tunnel, which is good. But I think one thing everyone should be careful of is just knowing that we're all going to experience a lot of trauma after this. It's kind of, I think we're all in shock and survival mode. And there's also a little bit of fatigue as some people are just getting very antsy. And then with the economic depression, it's even if I don't think we'll ever go back to normal, quote unquote. I think we're going to go to a new normal. We're going to have a new life. Masks are a permanent part of our lives. We have a heightened awareness of how we get infected, you know, washing our hands. And I think we're going to see a lot of, unfortunately, we're going to see a lot of long-term PTSD happening after this. But I think that because we've all gone through it together throughout the world, this is a planet-wide traumatic effect we've all gone through. I think the positive thing is that we can all help each other and support each other afterwards as we cope with the after effects of this.
Wow, that's a brilliant take, and I agree totally on that. Do you think there's a message in it, Paula? It sounds like I'm asking a metaphysical question. One can interpret it that way, but that perhaps a couple things that we could slow down, maybe we should slow down, maybe we need to bring ourselves more in alignment with the planet and its other living systems, with the planet itself, maybe see how connected we all are. So since we're so interdependent, maybe we can be kinder, more equitable and compassion. Do you see it that way, or do you just see it more as just a virus? It's like any virus that's come out of here and it's doing its thing.
I think unlike the 1918 pandemic and other previous pandemics, this happened during a time of great social upheaval. Our country is coming to face another reckoning with racism. We have a very divided country in terms of political beliefs, and families are divided over the recent election. We had that insurrection in January, which was a very shocking and traumatic event as well. So I think that you're right. I think that we're realizing how that's a great word, too, that we are interdependent. I think one thing, because this virus was so new, and unlike other viruses such as the SARS virus, or even something like Ebola, if you got one of those viruses, you knew exactly what the symptoms were. You knew exactly what was happening. With this disease, it kept evolving. It was, oh, you just need to socially distance. You don't need masks, to, oh, no, you do need masks and you need to socially distance. And then, you know, there are other weird symptoms other than flu-like symptoms. You know, you can lose your sense of taste and smell. We might have to amputate your leg. Oh, you might have permanent long-term cognitive fuzziness from this. And we found out, oh, it's a blood vessel disease. It is so unpredictable. You could be asymptomatic. So I think because of that, one of the interesting things with this virus is I think it made a lot of us realize how interdependent we are, because a lot of us started staying at home, not because we were scared of the virus. I mean, I was, but a lot of people were staying at home because they didn't know if they were asymptomatic, and the guilt compounding all of this, knowing that you could go out there asymptomatic and unknowingly spread the virus to someone who would then spread it to their grandmother who would die. And so you would have essentially blood on your hands. So I think that there was also a compassionate interdependence happening among us, where we realized, wait a minute, even if I do want to go out, I don't think I should go out because I don't want to accidentally kill someone or infect someone with this disease. So I do think that that played a huge role in making us very aware. And that's what I mean by the new normal. I think we're a lot more aware now of how we are not isolated. Even if we do live alone, we're not isolated. We are all connected. And I think that that's something we're, I think in a way it's a positive thing, or it's a good thing to be reminded of, because we've kind of forgotten that, looking down at our iPhones all the time and, you know, just constantly doing selfies and being a little narcissistic just kind of kicked us in the pants and reminded us, look up from your phone.
Oh, so true. I love the way you took, where you took it too. We mentioned the Asian hate. The crimes are up 1,000-something% or more, some places 3,000% since Corona. You've been laying low. Doesn't it just break your heart? And we have to attribute it to the president at the time calling it the Chinese virus, the Wuhan flu, and almost encouraging violence. I feel like there is a cause and effect there, and it's tragic. Have you heard from friends and things like that? I know, and because I have a lot of friends that are Asian, it's a very quiet group that they don't report crimes usually statistically. They don't want to talk about stuff like that. That's cultural. That's what my friends have been telling me last night even. What have you heard, and have you seen or experienced any of it, even in your isolation?
Yeah, that's a lot of stuff you brought up, and I'll break it down. I'll start off by saying, yes, I have experienced COVID-related racism. White people have refused to get on elevators with me, even though we're socially distanced and wearing masks and sitting and standing at the, you know, they put the little feet down on the floor that you're supposed to sit on, and they see me, take one look at my face, even though I have a mask on, and say, oh no, and get off. It's hurtful, it's disgusting, and it's racist. And then I was actually even racially profiled outside my own house. I've had friends that have reported being spit upon, coughed on, and told China virus, go home, it's all your fault. A lot of the crime that has happened recently has been very shocking because it's elderly people being pushed down, and one was even killed. He was knocked down and basically went into a coma and died. So manslaughter was committed there. It's bad. In terms of not reporting it, there's a lot to unpack there. And I'm going to step back and say, Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders in this country have experienced outright violent and often fatal physical racist violence since, and we've been in this country for not decades, not for years, but for centuries. You know, it goes all the way back to the Chinatowns across America being purged, the Chinatown massacre in the 1800s in Los Angeles. The Japanese internment camps, or today they're now calling them concentration camps. There's a lot of, you know, because there have been so many politically correct ways of saying, oh, it's an internment camp. And so they're like, no, it's a prison. It's not a camp. You forced American citizens because of the color of their skin to be imprisoned in, you know, renovated horse track, racing track places and in the desert. You have the Chinese Exclusion Act, the first federal law to prevent people because of the color of their skin from becoming American citizens. So this outright type of racism, what I think people joke and they say it's old-fashioned racism, but that has always happened to us. Now, what happened in the 80s and 90s, and I'll talk a little bit about my book, but just giving more of a general history, the model minority myth started to happen. And a lot of people say, oh, but that's a positive myth because it's saying that you work hard, you go to the Ivy Leagues, you become lawyers and doctors, you're the American dream come true. And actually, it's not there's no such thing as a positive stereotype. That's a negative stereotype because it dehumanizes us, trivializes our individual achievements, and creates a racist monolith. And it also serves in terms of systemic governmental racism and white supremacy. It then makes Asian Americans, it puts us as a wedge between black and white relationships, and then it causes anti-blackness to happen in the Asian communities, and that's a whole other complicated topic that I'm happy to answer questions on. But so, and by the way, when I say white supremacy, I know people kind of flinch and go, wait a minute, I'm not wearing a KKK white hood, you know, I didn't lynch anyone, this is not slavery. And I think when we say white supremacy, what we actually mean is that white is the default in this country. Everything is centered around whiteness in this country. And so that shoves a lot of what Asian Americans have been going through to the side. And we've been basically erased. In other words, when we teach history in elementary school and high schools and colleges, a lot of Asian Americans, including myself, the World War II Japanese internment camps, that's like two sentences in a textbook. That's all we know. And I didn't even know about the Chinese Exclusion Act until I went to college. I didn't know about Vincent Chin until I went to college. I didn't know about the Chinatown purges until my 20s. I was so desperate for representation in media, pop culture, and history that I had to teach myself. That's unacceptable. This should be taught. There have been statistics out there about kindergarten through 12th grade where they have found that out of all the historical topics that are taught, it's I think about 80% white, and the rest is African American, Black history, Latino, and Native American, and 0% was Asian American history. And so because of that, we're considered quote unquote adjacent white, and we're not. And so then that's what happens when you have Vincent Chin, when you have coronavirus being called China virus, when you have this massive spike in anti-Asian racism because of coronavirus. We've been complaining, we've been talking this whole time, even before coronavirus, when Trump was elected president, there was already a surge in anti-Asian hate crimes after 2016. So this has been slowly building. And we've been all shouting, and we feel like Cassandra. No one's been listening to us until the Trojan horse attacked in Atlanta. And it's very upsetting. And I think the other thing I wanted to talk about, going back to model minority, is there's a lot of racist microaggressions that Asian Americans experience. If we don't experience being shoved in the street or being attacked physically for the color of our skin, we experience microaggressions such as, wow, your English is so good. Or, hey, where are you from? Oh, I'm from Connecticut. No, where are you really from? Or being called my Oriental, or saying things like, oh, of course you play the violin because all Asians are good at math and classical music. Now, all of those microaggressions, obviously it's worse to be hit or to be killed for the color of your skin. But a lifetime of these microaggressions leads to a lifelong trauma. And my friends and I often joke about being Asian American is like dying from a thousand, you know, the death by a thousand cuts, it's death by a thousand microaggressions. And so I think that being Asian American and Pacific Islander in this country is a very complicated topic, because we have both the violent racism that nobody talks about and erases from media coverage and history, and then we have all the microaggressions that everybody mistakes as privilege and as that's actually a positive thing when it's not. So, and then you have on top of it the immigrant population, where they don't speak English, they don't speak fluent English, they don't want to rock the boat, they're scared, they don't want to be deported. Believe it or not, we're not all crazy rich Asians. There's also crazy poor Asians. My joke is I'm a crazy cheap Asian, but there's such diversity within our community, and a very tiny part of a community is ever written about or displayed in the media. And I think I've said a lot. I'll stop. I tend to ramble. So forgive you. Please interrupt me at any point. Sorry about that.
Oh, no, quite the opposite. I was literally thinking that section is going into the What Matters Most Hall of Fame. This is going to be a whole exhibit.
I'm honored.
I was going to ask about our history, but you're so brilliant, you anticipated it, and you just slam dunked the shit out of it. So Hall of Fame, and go as deep as you want. I love the way you tied it all together. I would even add in, tragically, not a microaggression, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The only time we dropped the bomb twice, which we really didn't have to do, and the way it was justified, actually the history of it was rewritten because it became a PR disaster. Everything you said, and really, and I even learned a couple of things in there, thank you. To me, what screams about this, because we've done so many different shows from so many different angles, whether it's the glass ceiling, misogyny, slavery. I've had Native Americans on, a chief, one of the great Sioux leaders has come on many times to teach us. America is this humongous, genocidal, super racist, white patriarchy that will not admit it. That's the head scratcher. Overwhelming evidence. To me, white supremacy is the operating system. It's in everything, everything. And as I've gotten older and, you know, all the propaganda keeps falling away from, you know, the silliness we were taught in schools, the fairy tales, I'm like shocked. It's staggering. It's like we wake up and we find out, wait a minute, so we're the empire? Like it's Star Wars and we were the Death Star? Oh, my God. You know, this is like the end of The Usual Suspects with Kaiser Sozi. I'm just reeling here. Or since we're both movie people, if we were talking about defending your life, I'd be Albert Brooks going, my 3% is swimming. Am I right, though? I mean, we are the friggin' empire of the Death Star. And okay, that was our history, but we still don't want to deal with it. And I think that's how we ended up with Donald Trump. And that's still why Georgia passed those Jim Crow voting laws yesterday.
Yeah, it's been upsetting. I think it can be overwhelming. I would say we are a big country. We are a country of many diverse communities. And, you know, as you say, I think for a long time, we were doing a Band-Aid solution where it's like, oh, diversity, representation, not realizing that it's not just about diversity and it's not just about inclusion. It's about equity. You know, we can't, there's the playing field is not leveled. So I need a box to stand on just to even get to the level playing field. You know, what the Black community has to do, what the Latino and Native American, like all the LGBTQI, a community, just yeah, we all need boxes to stand on because the playing field is just tilted, and it's frustrating. And I think on a positive note, what I have noticed, and I'm just talking about being a children's book and young adult author, is that I think that today's generation, the younger generation, they're much more aware. They're growing up in a more diverse community. They're not as isolated as people our age and older were. Back in the day, because I'm Gen X, so growing up, I'm in my early 50s, you know, growing up, I was always the only one. And now I'm seeing schools that are very diverse, and I see kids of all different backgrounds playing together. And, you know, I'm seeing kids, you know, I see non-Asian kids reading my books, which I think is wonderful, because my books aren't meant for an Asian audience. They're meant for everyone to read. And I think that we talk about, I do tend to focus a lot of my work on, I guess the best way to say it is Asian pain, but I think we need to celebrate Asian American joy, Asian American positive contributions out there. And I think that we have to celebrate the positive steps we've made as well. And that's, but I think we're having right now, this is a difficult transition. I think right now we're having to take a long, hard look in the mirror and be accountable. And being accountable means not only addressing what we did wrong as a country, but also trying to find steps in the right direction to make sure it doesn't happen again, and not be performative, but make a tangible change for the future.
I love that. And I would add reparations to lots of cases. I think money talks.
Yes.
Sorry is the first step, owning it, teaching the truth, starting to change things, and I don't mean dropping cash from planes. You know, we're not going to, nothing insane. but I'm talking about smart, laser-focused, which will still make some mistakes, but let's take some of that bloated defense budget and let's pour it into the least among us and the communities and fire up education and businesses and green spaces. Let's offer mental health therapy for free, which will help the opioid epidemic. Let's give everybody health insurance. It's a God-given right. Let's pay people enough money to live. All of these things, without a doubt, are fact, will lift everybody. And I know that sounds cliche, but violence will go down. Just look at the Nordic countries or any place that does it better. Which more lately is just about everywhere, PR department aside, and chest bumping. And do you have any ideas?
Yeah, I agree with you completely. I agree. Show me the money. Show us the money. I think that yes, I definitely believe in reparations. I believe in terms of tangible change. Yes, it's policy change. It's changing our laws. It's as you say, whether it's reparations or reallocation of, you know, the budgets to help the poorest of neighborhoods, whether it's, there are many, then that's out of my league. That's above my pay scale. I am not an expert in any of that, but I think that because we have more diverse politicians, there's a lot of Asian and Pacific American Islander politicians out there as well. I mean, in fact, Grace Meng in New York was the one who she passed the resolution about condemning anti-Asian racism due to the pandemic, and that happened late last year. And so there have been steps being taken forward. And I think for me, the tangible thing I can do are my books and the screenplays that I write, where I have positive, authentic realistic portrayals of Asian American characters and stories because our voices need to be heard. I think with my books, not only are they enjoyable to read, but they should be taught in schools. And a lot of my books are being taught in schools. And that's the tangible effect I hope to have. And I think with my Vincent Chin book, I originally was working on it as a screenplay. And then my book agent, when I mentioned it to her, she suddenly said, why aren't you doing this as a nonfiction book? And having gotten my master's in journalism, I thought, and I had written some children's nonfiction books, I thought, yeah, this should be a narrative nonfiction book. And then my agent said, this should be a narrative nonfiction book for the young adult crowd. And I at first thought, well, it's kind of an adult topic. You know, there's a lot of R-rated language. The killing took place. There was a fight at an adult entertainment nightclub on the night of the young man's bachelor party. And then I realized, wait a minute, young adults, teenagers today are very sophisticated. They can handle anything. And a lot of harsh history has been taught to them. They can handle it. So I wrote the book for everyone. I wrote it as if I was writing for an adult audience, but it's aimed towards high school students, but it's written at a level for everyone. And it's sophisticated enough for adults to read. I don't patronize. I don't sanitize. It's all there. The famous testimony when Ronald Ebens beat Vincent Chin to death with a baseball bat, witnesses testified that he allegedly said, it's because of you little motherfuckers that we're out of work. And this took place during the height of Japanese import cars beating in competition the American auto industry. And there were hundreds of thousands of layoffs happening at the time at Chrysler, GM, and Ford. And this took place in Michigan, home of the Big Three. So all of that is in the book. And I also have exclusive interviews with people who have not talked about the case in over 40 years. I've read every single court transcript from all the trials. We're talking 2000 plus pages of court transcripts that I have taken notes and read, first person interviews with many of the people involved in the case, the friends that went to the bachelor party at the time. I even met Ronald Ebens. It was an off the record conversation, but I did meet him at his house. I'm one of the first people to do that in decades. So I think it's a very important book. And I think that in the book, I also talk about some of the past Asian American history, from the Chinese laborers who worked on the Continental Railroad to the Chinese Chinatown massacre and so forth. So for me, that's my way of paying educational reparations, because I think we need educational reparations in our school system where this stuff needs to be taught. So I'm proud of that, and I hope that this helps.
I agree. I think that's a great take, especially for the generations coming up. Paula, did you grow up wanting to be a writer? Or I know you did journalism. Were you thinking to be a newspaper reporter or journalist? What was your thing when you were young?
Well, growing up, I always wanted to be a writer. The first book I read in the first grade was Charlotte's Web, and I wanted to be like Charlotte the Spider. I wanted to write. And I actually wrote my first book. It was 70 handwritten pages when I was in the second grade, and I sent it off to HarperCollins. Because they published a lot of my favorite books when I was growing up as a kid. And they wrote a very nice letter back saying, you're really talented. You should write a story for our children's writing contest for kids ages 7 to 10. And the famous story is I got mad, I burst into tears, and I ripped the letter up in front of my mom and dad and started crying. And I said, I'm not a child writer. I'm a real writer. So to this day, I kind of regret my parents never kept the letter. And so that was my first rejection, and I didn't take it well. Ironically, about 30-some years later, I would get published by HarperCollins for my first young adult novel, Good Enough, which I'll talk about more in a second. But so ever since elementary school, I always wanted to be a writer. And when I graduated from high school, I majored in English at Yale University, and I wanted to be a novelist. But while I was there, I realized, you know, I think I'm a little too young to write the great American novel. I should live life and be a reporter just like Hemingway was. So I applied to Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. And during that time, my whole life, I had always been very much into the news. I always watched, Dan Rather, Tom Brokaw, you know, after school, I would always watch those news broadcasts. I'd read the Hartford Courant, the New York Times. I was editor of my high school newspaper. I was one of the editors of the Yale Herald. And so yeah, I loved journalism. So I thought, you know what? Yeah, this is a good idea. Let's go to Columbia, get my master's in journalism, and let's do journalism for a while. And so I went to Columbia. Then I ended up being, I was a reporter for the Seattle Times and then the Detroit News and then People Magazine. So journalism was my training, and I'm really grateful for all the training, you know, learning how to write on deadline, learning how to dig, learning how to, what the point of view of a story is. All of that was great training. And then I ended up leaving journalism in 2000, and I taught for 2 years at Glendale Community College. I was an adjunct professor, just teaching English composition writing for first-year students at Glendale Community College. And I was thinking, oh, this is what I'm going to do, and I'll just work on my books, because at the time, too, I had also just sold my first children's book about Dr. Sammy Lee, who was the first Asian-American man to win a gold medal at the Olympics. And he had an interesting story, because growing up, he was forbidden from swimming in his own town community pool because he was not white. And I remember thinking, what an incredible, inspiring story. So that led to my career of writing children book, picture book autobiographies of Asian. I wrote about Dr. Sammy Lee. I have another book on Anna Mae Wong, the first Asian-American movie star, woman, Asian-American female movie star. I wrote about Dr. Muhammad Yunus, who won the 2006 Nobel Peace Prize for trying to eradicate poverty with his concept of microloans for devastated, poverty-stricken communities in Bangladesh. And that became an international phenomenon. And we have microloan and microbanking in America as well. And then I wrote my Good Enough novel, which was inspired young adult kind of romance, funny novel inspired by my life as a violinist, you know, youth orchestra and all of that. So during that time, I was teaching and working on my books, and I thought, oh, I'm just going to hopefully maybe get a full-time job teaching English at one of these community colleges, and I'll be very happy doing that and working on my books. And that's when a friend said, you know, I can't believe you don't write for TV and movies, because you watch so much TV and movies. That's my other pop culture hobby. So I thought, okay. So I basically wrote a script. I'd never written one before, and submitted it to the Warner Brothers drama writing TV workshop just for fun. It was like a bucket list thing. I thought, I've never written a script before. This is a fun thing. Let's just do it. So I literally did it for fun, sent it in as a lark, because it was a bucket list dream. And then I went back to teaching and working on my books. And then 6 months later, Warner Brothers called and said, hey, you got into the program. So that's what led to my transition to being a screenwriter. So by day, I write for TV and movies, and by night, I work on my books and play my violin and play with my cats. And I think it's come full circle, because working on the Vincent Chin book and also working on the even the picture book biographies, I still did a lot of reporting. But I think especially with Vincent Chin, I think things came full circle, and I realized you can take the girl out of the newspaper, but you can't take the newspaper out of the girl. So I've kind of come full circle with that, I think.
Okay, and where do you find the balance? I know you're working a ton. You're under deadline, because we've been texting. Do you at least get out and take walks in the park? Do you ever meditate? Is the violin your meditation? How do you turn it all off? Obviously, you're beyond brilliant. You're driven. You're gifted. How do you turn it off and step back so you don't flame out like one of those shooting stars we love to see?
You know what it is? It's my whole life, my personality. I always love to do a lot of things. It's just kind of my personality. Like in high school and college, I was concertmaster of my youth orchestra, and I was editor of the school newspaper, and I was taking 8 classes. So it's always been kind of my personality. And I think it's because I'm very restless and I get bored easily. And I'm also very curious about lots of different things. So I think that's just been part of my personality. Do I burn out? Do I freak out and cry and go, I bit off more than I can chew? Of course I do. So I think over the years, what helped me was music, because I think playing the violin, I do it now more for fun. I would consider myself a semi-professional, because, you know, I get paid to play occasionally. I've done some professional gigs. So, but I just love to play, and it's more, it just gives me peace. And I would say that my meditation is playing the violin. I'll pull out my violin and just play, and that's actually my meditation. And I would say it's physical exercise, so I'm standing up, so I'm burning calories, right? You know, and kind of part of the 10,000 steps. So I would say definitely my meditation is that. But I also, one thing I have learned is a lot of times people just, yeah, people are kind of stunned. They're like, how do you do all this? And I think what it is I am just, how do I put this? I don't do a lot. And that, if that makes sense, basically, if I get stuck when I'm on deadline, I walk away. I turn the computer off and I just watch Food Network. I watch cooking shows, you know, or I'll just sit there and play with the cats. Or I won't even play the violin. I'll just sit in front of the TV and watch a movie that I've seen 8 million times, you know, that I have memorized. Or, you know, or I'll take a nap. And I'm just like, you know what, I'll let my subconscious work on it. I'll get it done when I get it done. So I think that that has helped me. I think sometimes the best writing, the best work that I've done is when I just walk away. I shut the lid on my laptop and I just go have fun. I call a friend. Before the pandemic, you know, I would meet a friend and go out for drinks, you know, or have a nice dinner or something like that. So I think that what people have to realize is that in order to, you know what it is? I know how to say it. Forgive me for rambling. It's not about working hard. It's about working smart. So I work smart, if that helps. And working smart means I do take a lot of breaks. A lot of times my husband will come in and I'm playing a video game on my phone and I look at him and I say, get out, I'm working. So it's basically work smart, not hard.
I love it. And I'm so happy you're married. I'd actually be concerned. I'd be sending people to the house right now. And you have such a, you know, you just were born with this huge motor. I mean, you're a jet engine. How are you navigating the brutal shoals of Hollywood in the business? I mean, even the most successful have horror stories. I've read all of William Goldman's books, the classic, the greatest screenwriter ever.
Yes.
You are obviously thriving in it.
Yes.
But it's still brutal, isn't it? I mean, how do you... Do you just have great people you're working with? Your agent sounds fabulous, but how do you keep your sanity? Because you are killing it, but it's also, it's a tough business.
Yeah, it is. My first job was kind of a fairy tale. My first job was actually The West Wing. I was a staff writer there, and it's been downhill ever since. No, I'm just kidding. But, you know, and I've worked for shows like Mozart in the Jungle, Supergirl, and a bunch of shows on side. I have a very very varied, diverse list of credits. And I recently sold a pilot to Peacock that I'm finishing the final revisions on. So fingers crossed, that's set in the world of K-pop. And I am also working on a feature project, a job that I can't really talk about in detail yet because it hasn't been announced. So I'm very grateful that I've been able to work every year of my life in Hollywood, because not a lot of people can say that. The average screenwriter works once every 2 to 3 years. So I've been very lucky, and I do have my agents and my manager are wonderful. I'm very grateful to our Writers Guild Union, of course. And I do feel very lucky and privileged. Having said that, yes, I have experienced sexism, misogyny, and racism most of the time all at once. There have been very dysfunctional rooms where people are very mean and cruel to each other, where things are said, hey, I'm just joking, or very R-rated stuff gets discussed that I would have to walk out of the room because I was like, I can't talk about this. This is very inappropriate. And this all happened before the hashtag MeToo movement, before the awakening of racism in Hollywood, because a lot of it in Hollywood, it isn't, and, you know, the old boy network. So there's a lot of locker room talk. So if you are a woman writer or a writer of color, or worse, a woman writer of color, you know, or if you are from a disenfranchised, marginalized community, like if you're LGBTQ and all of that, you a lot back in the old days, in order to survive, you have to become one of the boys. You had to say the joke first to prove that you had a tough skin and you have a sense of humor. You can put up with this stuff. And that's sellout behavior. That's disgusting. We shouldn't have to do that. And I think that there's been a reckoning in Hollywood. They're realizing, we're like, no, we're not going to laugh at your jokes. We're not going to play along and be one of the guys or whatever. No, it's what you're saying is wrong. It's racist. It's sexist. It's inappropriate. It doesn't contribute to the stories that we're trying to tell for our television show about, you know, aliens from outer space or the White House. And so I think that there's been more responsibility. And in the latest jobs that I've had, I noticed a huge change where people were much more sensitive and compassionate. And we still talk about the tough topics, because even if you're writing a fun escapist show, you're still dealing with a lot of gravitas in terms of the themes. You're still addressing deeper themes, even if you are writing a comedy or a science fiction show or whatever. You know, the best of pop culture, you pull away the layers of the onion of laughter and jokes and silly aliens and makeup and costumes. And underneath at its core is a universal emotional theme that everyone can relate to. So we do have it's almost like being in a college dorm. You're having these intense conversations about life, love, prejudice, hatred, ignorance, whatever. So I find that all very rewarding, but I think that it's gotten better. Is it good? No, we still have a long way to go, but I'm glad that we're having these frank, open, honest discussions and people are being held more accountable. People are getting fired now for what they're doing. So in terms of survival, yeah. And then on top of it, you have to deal with just the usual Hollywood competition, like people getting jealous because, you know, this writer's the teacher's pet in the TV writer's room, or, you know, or you pitch an idea and then later somebody says, oh, the boss pitched this idea, and then you can't say anything because the boss gets credit, but you're like, that was my idea, you know, or, yeah, and there's a lot of competition because everyone wants to get their name on a script, so sometimes you have to deal with the old-fashioned, can I trust this writer, or are they going to throw me under the bus? So on top of all the sexism, misogyny, and racism, then you have to deal with just the classic William Goldman horror stories in Hollywood, and I would say bottom line, just to, because I know I'm rambling, just to conclude, I would say the way I have coped is, could I have done better on certain scripts? Did I make a few missteps myself? And yes, of course, I'm always growing and learning as a writer. I cringe at some of the lines of dialogue I wrote in my earlier scripts. I still cringe now at stuff that I write. I go, ooh, that could have, because you're always constantly revising because writing is a living document. And so, but I've learned, and I think a lot of writers have a hard time dealing with this. I can separate the writer from the writing. Yes, what I write is very personal. It's like the famous quote, I forgot who said it, about you cut open your, you put a cut on your hand and you bleed all over the typewriter. You know, so when people criticize your writing, you can't help but take it personally because you poured your heart and soul and your personal belief system into it. But I've learned at the end of the day, when people criticize my writing or when I have notes or when they say, you can do better, I always say, yes, I can do better as a writer. But they're not talking about Paula, you, the human being. So I never take it personally in terms of I'm a bad person. I'm like, no, I was a bad writer. That was bad writing. Okay, that was a cliche. So I think a lot of writers, that's a growth process. I wasn't like that when I started out. I was like, oh, you hate me. I'm a terrible person. You know, it's like I'm a fraud. I'm an imposter. But I think it's okay. I think it's okay to go through imposter syndrome because that's part of your growth as a writer. That's part of your journey. So, you know, yeah, so I think it's that, and you know what it is too, even with rejection, I tell people, whether you get rejected for your book or your script or you get fired from a job or whatever, it's like dating. Just because your boyfriend, girlfriend, significant other, whoever broke up with you, that doesn't mean you don't deserve to get married, you know, or to be in just a positive, you know, healthy relationship. So, you know, a lot of it is just, it's like dating, you know, you're not a bad person because they broke up with you. It just didn't work out, you know? And, so that's my tortured analogy for that. My metaphor for that.
I love these streams of consciousness. I have an idea. I'm going to pitch you a segment. Every once in a while you come on and we just do Paula's streams of consciousness.
I know. I'm sorry.
No, don't say you're sorry. They're brilliant. They are brilliant. Okay. They're just like, we have streams of consciousness. I guarantee it'll be a popular segment.
Okay.
You're just so brilliant. I love it. I am not pandering either. I'm just, and I've interviewed over 800, done 800 of these or more. All I do is talk to beautiful and brilliant people. You are unbelievable.
Oh, thank you. Well,
anyone who listens to this show will second that. Trust me. Trust me on this. Put your inner critic in the other room. Slam the door. Lock it. You're amazing. Hey, I have a question because we have a lot of LA people who listen because they write in, and also artists and things like that. You're further down the road. You're succeeding. I get asked a lot, but I don't feel like I have the knowledge that you have. What do you say to the inspired who want to go out there and move there or get involved? I just had a recent conversation with a listener who wrote in to me. She wanted to get out and go out there and write for TV. I gave her what little I knew. I know she listens. What do you say to those, and especially the women who have a dream in their heart who want to maybe move west or go to New York and write for Broadway? Anything that's sort of universal or that's really worked for you that you can impart to them that maybe will help them on their journey? I hear resilience for sure, but what else is there?
The thing I can say is have a huge portfolio, write as many samples. I'm going to talk specifically about television right now. For TV, you need a lot of samples. You need an original pilot. In the old days, you needed a spec episode, like an episode of Law and Order or something, you know, your own version of it. That's less the case today, but I still recommend doing one if you're starting out because it's a very helpful exercise because as a TV writer, you're hired to mimic. You didn't create the TV show that you were hired on, so you have to mimic their voice. You know, I'm not Aaron Sorkin. I have to imit, you know, we have to think, we have to always ask, what would Aaron Sorkin do when we were working on The West Wing and things like that? So you have to kind of emulate the characters that were created before you joined the show. So it does help to find a favorite show that you think you can kind of copy and imitate the voices on. And then other original things, like if you want to write a short story or a one-act stage play, all that stuff. And also in terms of pilots, it helps to have, I'm talking about drama specifically. I think a lot of this can be applied to comedy writing. But with an original pilot, you know, you've got your passion project. You know, you've got, you write that. If you want to write, if you're really into procedurals, like mystery shows, like Law and Order or, you know, all those shows out there, CSI, all those shows out there, then write a pilot that's more mystery driven, that's written kind of like, this could be the next CSI, because then your agent, or when you're applying for jobs, if you're going to apply to work at CSI, you're not going to send them a science fiction script. You're going to send them a similar mystery driven show. So but having said that, episode, the spec episode I wrote that got me hired on The West Wing was an Angel spec. An Angel was a horror comedy drama by Joss Whedon. So you never know. And so sometimes there's always an exception to the rule. But that's I would just recommend getting as much writing as you can done because the more you have out there, that's just going to help you. And also the more you write, it's like working out. The more you work out, the stronger your muscles get. So by the time you're on your fourth or fifth script, you write it faster. I would say today, my first draft is usually a beginning writer's third or fourth draft. It's still a draft and I've got to revise it, but I can kind of shortcut now. It's kind of like the Olympic runner who can do a 6-minute mile. I can't do that, but if I ran every day, hopefully I could get up to that time. So my biggest advice is to write as much as you can and to have a varied portfolio. So write your mystery thing if you want to be hired on a mystery show, but also write a lighter show because you might be considered for a different type of show. So you want to have like a diverse portfolio. So that is the biggest piece of advice I can give. And everything else is it's all in those books and those websites on how to succeed in Hollywood. Just do your homework, go to Google, look up all the practical advice column. There's so many resources out there. So the rest of it is all out there for people to find out.
Brilliant. How about you? What's your bigger dreams? Do you want to direct?
Oh, no. I've been on set. No, that's way too stressful. I prefer just being a writer. But because I am a producer, I do have to go on set for when I write an episode or, you know, if any of the original stuff I'm writing, if it gets greenlit to production, I will be the writer on set for that as well. I love collaborating with directors. I love talking to them. And I think it's it's an incredible job, but I could not be a director. Who knows? I might change my mind one day. I don't know. But for now, I think it's because I write books. I don't have the bandwidth for directing, but I do love being on set. It's brutal. The hours are long. It's really hard. You're bone tired afterwards, but it is fun being on set because when you write screenplays, you know, it's a collaborative effort. So it's quite an honor to see how everyone else interprets the words on the page. Whereas, and I think that's why I love books, because in books, I am the director, I'm the cinematographer, I'm in charge of wardrobe, you know, I do it all. So that's, I think, why I have never had a desire to be a director, because I'm fortunate enough to have books published. So to me, that fulfills the director itch, if that makes sense.
It does. And that is the even more evidence that how smart you are. I wouldn't be a director for any amount of money. Paul, I know you have a million things to do. I can't thank you enough for coming on. Will you really come back again, and no kidding aside, and just light it up maybe in a few months? You just have so much heart and soul to share here, and also very practical wisdom. You have tremendous grasp of the issues and of history. I would love to have you back.
Oh, thank you. Well, this was a lot of fun, and I hope I get to meet you in real life soon when it's safe and we're all vaccinated. Robert is a dear friend, and we're stand partners in the Vicente Chamber Orchestra, and we've played in other groups together, and he's my violin hero. I think he's incredible. So, no, I'd love to, and my book does come out from Norton Young Readers. It comes out April 20th. And I hate to say it, I just don't think the anti-Asian racism and racism in general, and also solidarity with Black Lives Matter and with all the communities, we've got a long way to go. So I don't think this conversation we had is going to end anytime soon. So I'm always honored and flattered and happy to help out in any way I can. You know, and again, especially if people have more questions about TV writing or book writing, I'm always happy to answer questions on that as well.
Oh, so true. And we will have to have lunch in L.A. on my next sojourn. I was going to be out there this year, but the pandemic put the ichnay on that. We'll go outside. We'll wear sunglasses. We'll sit in the sun. We'll people watch. Which will be great, though. We don't have to look like we're somebody, because we'll have you with us. So we'll have some street cred. And Robert is a great hang. I love hanging with Robert. We crack each other up, so that's all that matters.
Yeah, he's amazing. And we text quite a bit. There's a little group of us, me, Robert, and a couple other people. And we text each other. And I think that's helped during the pandemic, too. So it's been nice to keep in touch with everyone.
Well, have a beautiful, beautiful day. And stay in the flow. Stay safe. And I really appreciate the light you're bringing into the world. You are one of the lights that we need to light up this dark time.
Oh, this is so kind. And thank you for all that you're doing. I mean, you know, this podcast and everything that you're doing, it's amazing and creative as well. And much respect to you. Thank you.
You've been listening to the What Matters Most podcast, a 100% listener-supported program. If you feel inspired, please go to our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/whatmattersmost and join our family. So until the next time, stay inspired and in the light.